Okay, let's unpack this. Welcome to the deep dive, and specifically, welcome to what we hope will be a really intensive study session for you. Today, we're putting on our serious macro hats. We're aiming for a highly specialized, almost surgical dissection of a core part of monetary economics, classical models, and crucially, what they imply for policy. So if you're prepping for EC3 101.15, this deep dive is really designed to help you master the mechanics, the implications, and yeah, even the criticisms of this foundational framework.
That's absolutely right. You know, the classical model isn't just some historical footnote. It's really the benchmark. You have to understand it. Every modern macro theory, I mean, whether you're talking new classical, new Keynesian, they all define themselves against this classical baseline. How far do they deviate from that world where money is, well, perfectly neutral? Mm-hmm. What's fascinating here is, well, you can't grasp modern monetary policy without first getting absolute clarity on what happens theoretically when money is just a veil,
right?
When it doesn't fundamentally change real things.
Okay, so our mission today is pretty laser focused. We are definitely moving beyond just, you know, defining money supply and demand curves. That's not the goal here. We're diving deep into four really critical interconnected areas. First, we need to nail down precisely how classical output gets determined, the role of real factors.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we have to detail the exact consequences of monetary policy in this, well, pretty rigid classical world, that powerful argument for neutrality. Third, we'll pivot to business cycle models. What are things like real business cycle or RBC models actually trying to do, especially if they're explaining fluctuations without money?
Which is a key point.
And finally, we tackle those seemingly paradoxical models, the ones where prices are flexible, people are rational, but somehow money still manages to have real effects, at least in the short run. How does that work?
Okay, let's start right at the beginning then. The engine room, as you called it, of the classical economy. The factor markets. The most fundamental principle, the absolute bedrock here, is that real outcomes.
Yeah.
I mean, things like actual production, how many people are employed, investment decisions, the real purchasing power of wages. All determined only by real factors.
Only real factors.
Only real factors. This is basically the definition of money being a veil over the real economy.
And when we say real factors, just to be clear for everyone listening, we're talking about the deep structural stuff, right? Like
yes.
People's preferences, work versus leisure.
Exactly. Preferences, how much people save, the existing capital stock machines, buildings, infrastructure, and critically, the current state of technology.
Yeah.
How efficiently can we combine labor and capital?
Okay.
We formalize this usually through the aggregate production function. You'll see it written as output. Let's call it $1 in period T. Is a function of technology, add our dollars, and the inputs, add our labor and dollars for capital. So 10 at all, AFRT, at ENT.
AFRS is the technology shock into labor capital. Got it. And there's an assumption about returns to scale.
Yeah, typically constant returns to scale.
Yeah.
Double all your inputs, you double your output. Simple enough baseline.
So if we assume that capital stock, a K-dollar, is pretty much fixed in the short run, which is a standard assumption.
Right.
Then output really just depends on the current technology level and how much labor we decide to employ.
Exactly. Which leads us straight to the labor market. That's where a dollar gets determined.
And the classical view assumes this market works perfectly.
Perfectly and instantly. We assume perfect competition, complete price, and wage flexibility. The market clears. No unemployment queues, no sticky wages preventing adjustment.
So how do firms decide how much labor and a letter to demand?
Profit maximization, standard microeconomic principle. They'll hire workers right up at the point where the cost of that last worker equals the value of what that worker produces.
The marginal product of labor.
The marginal product of labor, exactly. MPL, which in our production function notation is derived from AFNT, KT. Specifically, it's the partial derivative with respect to labor, NPAR, let's call it, at F1NT, KT.
Okay. And the cost of the worker isn't just the nominal wage, is it? It's the real cost.
Crucially, yes. The firm cares about the real wage, the nominal wage, divided by the overall price level, two edges. The firm hires labor until this real wage equals the marginal product of labor, at F1NT, DKT, Chasey. That equation is the heart of the classical labor market.
This really highlights the power of that technology shock. So let's trace it through. What happens if we get a positive hour shock? Say, a sudden innovation makes everyone more productive.
Okay, good thought experiment. An above average N9T. Suddenly, the economy is fundamentally more productive. Each worker, using this better technology, can produce more output per hour.
Right.
This directly increases the marginal product of labor at F1NT, TDT, for any given level of employment. Graphically, the labor demand curve shifts outwards to the right.
So at the old real wage, firms suddenly think, hey, these workers are producing more, let's hire more of them.
Precisely. Now, we need the other side of the market, labor supply. Let's assume, for simplicity, the labor supply curve is upward sloping. People work more if the real wage is higher. And importantly, that the supply curve itself isn't directly shifted by this technology shock.
Okay, standard assumption.
So you have this outward shift in labor demand hitting a stable upward sloping labor supply curve. What happens at the intersection?
Well, the price has to go up, right? The price of labor.
The real wage to our dollars, yes, it gets bid up.
Yeah.
And because the real wage is higher, more people are willing to work, so the quantity of labor employed, Adler, also increases.
So after a positive technology shock, we end up with higher employment and higher real wage.
Exactly. Above average values for both ample and total dollars.
And this feeds back directly into output, one tile.
Directly. Output goes up for two clear reasons. One, you have more people working, and it goes higher. Two, each person working is more productive because of the positive technology shock. 8 amps is higher. It's a double boost to output.
That's a really powerful, clean mechanism. It explicitly links real outcomes, output, employment, real wages, directly to a real technological factor. 8 ala, no money involved here at all.
None whatsoever. And that mechanism establishes the equilibrium level of output, sometimes called the natural rate of output or potential output. It's maybe called Yaller for consistency. This Yaller is purely a function of these real factors: tastes, technology, capital, stock.
And crucially, because this equilibrium is determined by real factors and prices adjust instantly,
it means the aggregate supply, AS curve, in this model is vertical, completely vertical at this output level. Changes the overall price level have no effect on the amount of output the economy can sustainably produce.
Okay. Vertical AS curve, anchored at Yaller, determined purely by real factors in the factor markets, especially the labor market clearing based on technology. 8 and Daylers, that's the foundation.
That's the foundation. Now we can bring money into the picture and see why it doesn't matter for these real variables.
Right. So let's do that. Let's shock the system with monetary policy. Imagine the central bank decides to expand the money supply. Maybe they print money and buy government bonds in open market operations. HOMOs. A big injection of cash.
Okay, standard monetary expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need to trace this through the familiar ISLM and ADAS diagrams, but always remembering that key classical assumption: instant price flexibility. Everything adjusts immediately.
So, step one, the nominal shock itself. The increase in the nominal money supply. Naller, what does that do to aggregate demand, AD?
It shifts the AD curve outwards. More nominal money chasing the same amount of goods, essentially.
Right.
Let's say it shifts from $80 to $80 another.
And in the money market diagram, the LM curve, more money supply should shift that too, right?
Initially, yes. The increase in nominal dollar makes the existing interest rate too high for money market equilibrium, so the LM curve shifts outwards too, say from LMO dollar to the LMO one. Oh.
Now, if we stopped here in a sort of basic Keynesian model with sticky prices, that outward shift in LM would lower interest rates, boost investment, and increase output along a non-vertical AS curve.
Exactly. But we can't stop there in the classical model because the AS curve is vertical. It's fixed at $80.
Ah, right. So the AD curve shifts out to $80 one, but it hits this vertical AS curve at UL dollar. What happens at the initial price level, T dollars?
At TL Wilds, the new aggregate demand, $80 one, is now greater than the fixed aggregate supply odol. We have excess demand across the entire economy.
And because prices are perfectly flexible?
They adjust instantly to eliminate that excess demand. There's no period of disequilibrium. The overall price level immediately rises from P$ or to a new higher level, P$1.
How much does it rise?
Proportionally to the increase in the money supply. If the money supply increased by, say, 10%, the price level to Pleasant also increases by exactly 10%.
Okay, so the price level jumps. The increase in aggregate demand has absolutely no effect on the real output level. It just causes inflation.
Precisely. Output stays stubbornly fixed at UL.
But wait, what about the LM curve? We shifted it out to LM dollars because nominal money increased. If the price level dollars has now also increased, what does that do?
Ah, this is the crucial closing of the loop. Remember, the LM curve represents equilibrium in the money market, where the demand for real money balances equals the supply of real money balances. The supply is MPA.
Right, dollars over dollars.
The initial shift from LM dollars to LM and EA happened because nominal dollars went up. But now the price level dollars has also jumped up proportionally.
So if UPMA went up 10%, MO went up 10%.
Then the ratio MP, the real money supply, is exactly back where it started. Okay. MMP01 buy is equal to MMPOP.
Ah, so the increase in prices perfectly offsets the increase in nominal money, bringing the real money supply back down.
Exactly. And because the real money supply is back to its original level, the LM curve shifts straight back from LM wonder to its initial position, LM dollars, instantly.
Wow. So the monetary injection causes AD to shift out, prices jump immediately, and that price jump pushes the LM curve right back where it started. Net effect on output?
Zero. Absolutely zero. The economy starts at yoyas and ends at nayolas. All that happened was the price level dollars went up.
This is the core of monetary neutrality.
It is the definitive classical conclusion. Money is neutral.
Okay, let's summarize this really clearly for, you know, anyone revising this. How do we categorize the effects? Nominal variables versus real variables?
This is absolutely key. Nominal variables, these are affected. The price level goes up. Nominal wages also go up proportionally to keep the real wage constant, since the real wage is determined in the labor market by the MPL. So P&W increase.
Okay, nominal stuff changes.
But real variables, these are completely unaffected. Output remains unchanged.
Yeah.
Employment remains unchanged, determined by the real wage and MPL. The real wage itself remains unchanged. Real interest rates, real investment, all unchanged.
So money is just like changing the unit of account, like switching from measuring in inches to measuring in centimeters. Doesn't change the actual size of anything.
That's a perfect analogy. It just changes the numbers we use, mm-hmm. the nominal values, but not the underlying real structure or performance of the economy.
What does this imply for a central bank trying to, say, boost employment? Maybe push it below that natural rate determined by the factor markets.
It implies it's completely futile, certainly in the long run, or even in the short run, in this perfectly flexible model. Any attempt by the monetary authority to systematically use monetary policy to target real variables like employment is doomed.
Why doomed?
Because rational agents understand the structure of the economy. They know that monetary expansion only causes prices to rise. So any systematic expansion will just be factored into expectations, leading directly to higher inflation with no gain in employment or output. Employment stays at the natural rate.
This sounds like the foundation for arguing against activist discretionary monetary policy.
It absolutely is. It's the bedrock argument for why monetary authorities might be better off committing to simple, predictable policy rules like a fixed money growth rate or an inflation target. Trying to fine-tune the economy with discretionary policy, in this view, just leads to noise and inflation. This ties directly into later ideas about time and consistency, which we'll get to.
Okay, so classical model. Real factors drive real outcomes. Money only drives nominal outcomes, prices. AS is vertical. Policy is neutral. That's a clear, but maybe stark picture.
Very stark. And it raises a huge question.
Which is?
If this model is right, and output is just determined by smooth trends in technology and capital, how do we explain the actual business cycles we see? The booms and busts, the periods where output fluctuates significantly around its trend. If money can't cause these real fluctuations in the classical view, what can?
Right. That seems like a major disconnect from reality. That must be where business cycle models come in, especially real business cycle or RBC theory.
Exactly. That's the primary motivation. RBC models, pioneered by people like Kidlin, Prescott, Long, Plosser, they try to explain observed business cycle fluctuations using only real factors. No sticky prices, no monetary surprises needed.
So they stick with the classical idea that only real things matter for real outcomes, but they try to show how fluctuations in those real things, mainly technology shocks, can generate cycles that look like the ones we see.
Precisely. They are typically built on dynamic general equilibrium, DGE foundations. They assume rational, optimizing agents, often simplified down to a single representative agent, like Robinson Crusoe on his island, making complex choices about work, leisure, consumption, and investment over time.
Robinson Crusoe economics?
Well, it's a sophisticated version. It focuses entirely on how these rational agents optimally respond to changes in their environment, primarily those random technology shocks, et cetera, hitting the production function. The cycle is just the economy's optimal response to these real shocks.
Okay, so what are the key stylized facts of real-world business cycles that RBC theory claims it can explain quite well?
It actually does a surprisingly good job on several fronts. First, procyclicality. Lots of key variables tend to move together with output.
Like employment?
Yes. Employment is procyclical. Rises and booms, falls and recessions. Labor productivity, output per worker, is also generally procyclical. And importantly, the real wage is typically found to be procyclical too. RBC models generate this naturally. A positive technology shock makes labor more productive, increasing demand for labor, which pushes up the real wage and employment, leading to higher output. Everything moves together.
Okay, pro-cyclicality matches. What else?
A really big one is the relative volatility of consumption and investment. Empirically, investment spending is much, much more volatile than consumption spending over the business cycle.
People spending on food and clothes doesn't jump around as much as firms spending on new machines or buildings.
Exactly. And RBC theory explains this beautifully through the assumption of risk-averse agents who want to smooth their consumption over time. This links back to ideas like Milton Friedman's permanent income hypothesis, PIH.
Explain that link. How does consumption smoothing lead to volatile investment?
Okay, so the PIH basically says you base your consumption today not just on your income today, but on your expected average or permanent income over your lifetime. Agents don't like big swings in their consumption.
Right, they prefer a stable lifestyle.
So when a temporary positive technology shock hits, boosting their income temporarily, they know their long-run average income hasn't changed that much. What do they do with the extra income?
Save it.
Mostly, yes. To keep consumption smooth, they absorb the temporary income fluctuation primarily through changes in saving. And in these models, saving directly translates into investment buying capital for future production. So temporary income shocks get channeled into highly volatile saving and investment decisions, while consumption remains relatively stable.
That's quite elegant. The model's microfoundations, rational agents, smoothing utility naturally generate this observed macro pattern of smooth consumption and volatile investment.
It's considered one of the major successes of the RBC approach. It shows how individual optimization can lead to aggregate volatility patterns.
Okay, so it matches procyclicality and investment volatility. What about the nature of the shocks themselves versus the cycles they create? You mentioned the shocks are often assumed to be simple.
Yeah, often modeled as serially uncorrelated, meaning a shock today tells you nothing about a shock tomorrow and maybe independent across different sectors of the economy. Just random noise hitting technology.
But real business cycles aren't just random noise. They last for a while, right?
Right.
Booms persist, recessions persist, and things tend to move together across the economy.
Exactly. Observed cycles exhibit persistence. Positive serial correlation booms tend to follow booms. Recessions follow recessions. And commovement, positive cross-sectional correlation, different sectors tend to boom or bust together. A key function of RBC models is to show how the internal propagation mechanisms of the economy transform those simple random shocks into output series that look like actual business cycles.
How does that happen? What are the propagation mechanisms?
The most important one is capital accumulation. Think about it. A positive technology shock today doesn't just boost output today. It also makes investment more attractive.
Because the return on new capital is higher.
Right. So agents invest more. This increases the capital stock for tomorrow, KT plus any mile. A higher capital stock tomorrow means higher potential output tomorrow, even if the technology shock itself fades away. Investment decisions link periods together and make the effects of a temporary shock persist over time.
So the decision to invest turns a short blip into a longer wave.
Precisely. That generates persistence. And commovement arises because the aggregate technology shock, AT2012, affects the productivity of capital and labor across the board. It shifts investment demand and labor demand simultaneously in the same direction throughout the economy, causing broad measures of activity to move together.
Okay, so RBC theory can take simple tech shocks and generate persistent, widespread cycles with procyclical variables and volatile investment, all without needing money or sticky prices.
Sounds impressive.
It is theoretically impressive, however. Ugh, the who, however. I sense criticisms are coming. The sources mentioned four key ones. We should definitely cover these for anyone preparing for an exam essay on this.
Absolutely. The critiques are significant. First, and perhaps most fundamentally, is the difficulty in actually identifying and measuring these crucial technology shocks, $80.
How are they usually measured?
Often as the solid residual, basically, the part of output growth that can't be explained by growth in measured inputs like capital and labor hours. But this residual is a bit of a black box. It likely captures not just pure technological change, but also things like measurement errors in inputs, changes in how intensively capital and labor are used, factory utilization, maybe even non-technological things like changes in regulations.
So attributing the entire business cycle to something we can't clearly measure or isolate is problematic.
It's a major challenge, yes. Critics argue RBC attributes too much explanatory power to an unobservable driving force.
Okay, critique number one, identifying the shocks. What's number two?
It relates to the labor market predictions. To match the observed large swings in total hours, worked over the business cycle alongside relatively small fluctuations in the average real wage.
Which is what we tend to see empirically.
Right. To get that pattern, RBC models typically require the aggregate labor supply curve to be quite flat, meaning very responsive or elastic, to changes in the real wage.
People need to be willing to drastically change their working hours in response to small wage changes.
Yes. But many empirical studies suggest that aggregate labor supply is actually relatively inelastic, especially for primary earners. People don't seem to change their hours that dramatically when the wage nudges up or down. So there's a tension between the model's requirement and the microeconomic evidence on labor supply.
Okay, so difficulty identifying shocks and potential inconsistency with labor supply evidence. What's the third critique? This one sounds particularly damaging, linking back to prices.
It is a major empirical hurdle. Basic RBC theory, driven by supply-side technology shocks, fundamentally predicts that the price level should be countercyclical.
Countercyclical, meaning prices go down in booms and up in recessions.
Exactly. Think about it. A positive technology shock makes production cheaper, lowers marginal costs. In a competitive market, this should lead to lower prices during an economic boom. Conversely, a negative technology shock, recession, raises production costs and should lead to higher prices.
But is that what we actually see? Do prices fall when the economy is booming?
The empirical evidence is, let's say, murky at best and often points the other way. Many studies find inflation tends to be pro-cyclical, rising in booms, or at least acyclical. A consistent counter-cyclical price level is certainly not a strongly established empirical fact. This is a significant challenge to the core mechanism of standard RBC models.
Yeah, if your main prediction about price is wrong, that's a problem.
Okay, and the final critique is more of a methodological warning about data analysis.
Yes, and it's crucial for anyone doing or reading empirical macro work. It concerns the use of detrending techniques, especially the Hodrick-Prescott HP filter. That's the standard tool used to separate the long-run trend from the short-run cycle in macroeconomic time series. Right?
It is, but it's a purely statistical tool, and researchers need to be extremely cautious because the HP filter, by its mechanical nature, can sometimes induce cyclical patterns and correlations between series, even when none exist in the underlying data.
You mean you could take two totally unrelated random series, HP filter them, and find they look like they move together cyclically?
It's possible, yes.
Well,
it can create what's called spurious cyclical behavior. So the warning is, don't just report that two HP-filtered series are correlated. You need to be careful, check robustness, report standard errors, and ensure the correlations are statistically meaningful and not just an artifact of the filter. Otherwise, the stylized facts you think your model is explaining might not even be real.
Okay, that's a really important practical point. So RBC tries to explain cycles with real shocks, has some successes like investment volatility, but faces big hurdles with identifying shocks, labor supply elasticity, the countercyclical price prediction, and potential data filtering issues.
That's a fair summary. And the fact that it struggles, especially with price behavior, and completely dismisses any role for money or monetary policy in cycles, leaves the door open for other approaches.
Exactly. Which brings us to our final section. We've established the pure classical model where money is neutral. We've looked at RBC trying to explain cycles without money. Now, how can we have models where prices are still flexible, but money does manage to have real effects, at least temporarily?
Right. This is where it gets really interesting. Theoretically, if you want money to matter for real outcomes, but you want to keep the assumption of flexible prices and rational agents, you need to introduce some kind of friction or imperfection other than sticky prices.
What kind of imperfection?
The key ones are usually imperfect information or misaligned incentives between policymakers and the public. Let's look at two major examples.
Okay, first up.
The monetary misperceptions model, most famously associated with Robert Lucas. This model keeps flexible prices, keeps rational expectations, but crucially assumes agents have imperfect information.
Imperfect information about what?
About the source of price changes they observe locally. It hinges on what's called the signal extraction problem.
Okay, break that down. What signal are they trying to extract?
Imagine you're a producer, maybe a farmer, selling wheat. You see the price of your wheat go up in your local market. Now you're rational, but you don't have perfect instantaneous information about every single price in the entire economy.
Right. You mostly know your own market well.
So when you see your wheat price rise, you face uncertainty. Is this rise happening because A, there's a genuine increase in relative demand for wheat specifically, a real change, meaning you should produce more wheat? Or is it because B, The central bank has increased the money supply, causing all prices, including wheat, to rise generally a nominal change, meaning you shouldn't change your real production plans.
They can't immediately tell if it's a real signal about their specific product or just general inflation noise.
Exactly. They have to make a judgment based on incomplete information. Now, suppose the central bank executes a surprise monetary expansion, something the public didn't anticipate.
An unanticipated increase in the dollars.
This causes a general increase in the aggregate price level. But individual producers, seeing their own price rise, will likely attribute part of that rise to a real increase in demand for their specific good. They temporarily misperceive the aggregate nominal shock as having a local real component.
And because they think demand for their product is up,
they increase their output and maybe hire more labor temporarily. So the unanticipated monetary shock through this misperception mechanism causes a short-run increase in real output and employment.
So money can have real effects here, but only if it's a surprise.
That's the absolute key takeaway, and it leads to a very powerful policy implication, often linked to the Lucas critique. Monetary policy can only affect real variables via its unanticipated component. The part of money growth that people didn't see coming, one of the ET1MLOT, where ET1 and Plotik explains, is expectations formed last period.
What happens if the central bank tries to systematically surprise people? Say they always try to create 2% inflation, hoping to boost output.
It doesn't work. Rational agents will quickly figure out the central bank's systematic behavior. They will anticipate the inflation, build it into their wage and price-setting decisions, and the element of surprise disappears. The policy becomes fully anticipated.
And if it's fully anticipated,
then it has no real effect. The entire impact just shows up as higher inflation, exactly like in the basic classical model. Systematic, predictable monetary policy is ineffective for influencing real variables in this framework.
So the only way policy works is by essentially tricking people. That doesn't sound like a sustainable strategy.
It's not. It highlights a major credibility problem. If the central bank constantly tries to engineer surprises, it loses credibility, expectations adjust, and it ends up back in the classical world, but potentially with higher average inflation. This leads us very naturally to the second model,
which focuses on those incentives.
Yes. The time inconsistency problem, often associated with Barrow and Gordon, building on earlier work by Kidlin and Prescott. This model takes the natural rate hypothesis and rational expectations seriously and asks, what happens if a policymaker has discretion to set monetary policy period by period?
Discretion meaning they aren't bound by a fixed rule.
Exactly. They can choose the optimal policy each period based on the current situation. Now, assume the policymaker has objectives typically. They dislike both inflation and unemployment deviating from some target levels.
And critically, let's assume their target unemployment rate is below the economy's natural rate of unemployment, $1. Maybe they want unemployment to be 3% when the economy naturally settles at 5%.
Right. This creates the core problem. If the public expects low inflation, the policymaker sees a tempting short-run opportunity. They think, if I create some surprise inflation right now, I can temporarily push unemployment down closer to my target dollar, maybe win an election. They have an incentive to inflate more than they promised or than the public expects.
They're trying to exploit that short-run Phillips curve trade-off that exists only when inflation is unexpected, based on the Lucas model logic.
Precisely. They face this temptation period after period. But here's the catch. The public is rational. They understand the policymaker's objectives and incentives. They know the policymaker wants to create surprise inflation.
So the public won't believe promises of low inflation.
They won't. They will rationally expect the policymaker to give in to the temptation. They will form their expectations, anticipating the inflation that the policymaker finds optimal to create, given the incentive structure.
So the surprises can't happen systematically. Everyone knows the policymaker has an incentive to inflate, so they expect inflation. What's the end result? The equilibrium under discretion.
The result is suboptimal, often called the discretionary equilibrium or inflation bias. It has two main features. First, you get an excessively high average rate of inflation, higher than what the policymaker would choose if they could credibly commit to a low inflation rule.
Okay, high inflation. What about unemployment? Does the attempt to push it below the natural rate succeed?
No, that's the kicker.
Yeah.
In equilibrium, unemployment remains stuck at the natural rate under dollars. It's completely independent of the high inflation rate. The policymaker tries to use inflation to get lower unemployment. The public anticipates it, neutralizing the real effects. And we just end up with the costs of high inflation and no benefit in terms of lower average unemployment.
It's a trap. the policymaker keeps inflating because not inflating when high inflation is expected would cause a nasty recession. Unemployment would rise above $1. But because everyone expects the inflation, it doesn't help unemployment stay below $1.
Exactly. It's a stable but inefficient equilibrium. The only way to escape this high inflation trap, according to the model, is to remove the policymaker's discretion.
How?
Through credible commitment mechanisms. Things like legally binding inflation targets, central bank independence designed to focus solely on price stability, or fixed rules that tie the policymaker's hands and convince the public that the incentive to inflate won't be acted upon.
So ironically, these flexible price models, where money can have short-run effects due to misperceptions or the temptation for surprise inflation, end up making perhaps the strongest case for rules and commitment, reinforcing the long-run classical view that systematic discretionary policy is ineffective or even harmful.
That's a very good way to put it.
Yeah.
The potential for short-run non-neutrality under discretion leads directly to an argument for institutions that try to restore long-run neutrality and low inflation.
Yeah.
Again, only the unanticipated part of money or inflation has real effects, and you can't systematically anticipate the unanticipated.
Okay, wow. We've covered a lot of ground there. Let's try to quickly recap the main stages for everyone listening.
Good idea. So first, we established the pure classical benchmark output, determined solely by real factors at NTKTT via the production function and instantly clearing factor markets, leading to a vertical AS curve.
Then, the stark implication, monetary neutrality. Changes in the money supply only affect nominal variables like prices and nominal wages, proportionally, leaving all real variables, output, employment, real wage, completely untouched. LM curve snaps back via price adjustments.
Third, we looked at real business cycle, RDC models, as an attempt to explain observed cycles using only real shocks and optimal agent responses, like consumption smoothing via PIH leading to volatile investment. We noted their successes, but also major criticisms regarding shock identification, labor supply, the countercyclical price prediction, and data filtering issues.
And finally, we explored flexible price models where money can have short-run real effects, but only through deviations from perfect information or incentives. Key examples: the Lucas misperceptions model, unanticipated shocks trick agents via signal extraction, and the Barrow-Gordon time inconsistency model. Discretionary policy leads to an inflation bias with no long-run gain in output employment, highlighting the need for commitment.
That covers the core sequence.
Excellent. That feels like a very solid overview of these critical, classical, and related models for EC3D115 preparation. Before we wrap up, do you have a final thought, maybe connecting this seemingly abstract theory to the bigger picture of modern policy?
Yeah, maybe one thing to ponder. If we connect this to the bigger picture, even when macroeconomics largely shifted towards new Keynesian models in the 80s and 90s models, which explicitly includes sticky prices to give monetary policy more short-run traction, think about what central banks were often trying to do.
Stabilize inflation and output.
Yes, but stabilize output around what? Often the objective functions in these modern models involve minimizing deviations of actual output from the equilibrium output level. Yes, sometimes called potential output. And how is that Yang determined?
Still by the underlying real factors like technology and labor supply, the classical determinants.
Exactly. That equilibrium output, the economy's long-run potential, is still fundamentally rooted in the real side, classical determinants we started with at FNTAKT. So even when models allow for short-run deviations and a role for policy stabilization, the ultimate target or anchor often remains that classical real determined level.
The classical concept of potential output never really went away.
It never really went away. It remains the benchmark. And this raises, I think, a really important ongoing question for policy. If that long-run classical outcome, that real potential output, always serves as the anchor, how much short-run gain from stabilization policy? How much temporary reduction in unemployment below the natural rate perhaps is actually worth the potential long-run costs? Costs like higher average inflation, loss of central bank credibility, or distorted price signals, which might arise from trying too hard to exploit that very fleeting short-run trade-off allowed by sticky prices or misperceptions. It forces you to constantly weigh the temporary benefits against the risk of undermining that long-run classical anchor. That tension is still very much at the heart of monetary policy debates today.